Hello, and welcome to another Future Pharmacist Conference session. So, yeah, interesting one tonight. We've got, well, it's billed as a debate, so the future of community pharmacy screening services. There's been an awful lot of sort of work done in this area over the years, or not done, as the case may be. And I think it's, I don't know, the panel can sort of come in later on and put me right here. But there's been a lot of pilotitis in this area. There's been a lot of pilots, AF screening pilots, and all sorts of interesting things that have, some have flown and some have fallen by the wayside. But I think, I don't know, I thought this session could be quite interesting, not least because of the expertise we've got on the line, but also just the lie of the land post-COVID. You know, there's a lot of need for this in my view. It's just, I suppose, the economic and medical need. Does the cost benefit analysis stack up? And maybe that's what we'll touch on later on. So anyway, more importantly, on the line, so we've got three very learned friends this evening. So we've got Dr. Alexia. Hello. And Alexia, it's lovely to have you with us. So Alexia is a GP, she's also clinical lead at technology-enabled care at NHS Ayrshire and Arran. And she's an associate advisor in quality improvement and patient safety. And she's, as if that isn't enough, she's also a CPD advisor at NHS. So Alexia, very nice to welcome you. We've also got Matt Barclay, so yeah, good friend of pharmacy and practice. So Matt's a pharmacist, still locums the odd time, but his current primary role is Director of Operations at Community Pharmacy Scotland. So Matt, really, really grateful for your time as well. And then finally, Lindsay Steele. Lindsay is lead GP pharmacist at the moment, that's her role. And she works in a practice in NHS Orkney and she's got a special interest in simulation-based education, and perhaps relevant to this conversation, an interest in cardiology. So it's quite a big topic. So where do we start? I mean, Alexia, I was saying before the call, one of the reasons I invited you on, not to pick on you, sorry, in terms of going first, but one of the reasons I invited you was because I spied some really interesting work you'd been doing down in the southwest of Scotland in this area, particularly around AF screening. I wondered if you might like to sort of kick off and, you know, just tell us a wee bit about what you've got up to and some of the opportunities and so on.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. So I think this all really came about at the start of the pandemic when two different barriers presented themselves for work that I was doing. One was that as the clinical lead for tech, we had got access to cardia devices with the intention of being able to screen patients when they're attending for their long-term condition reviews in practice. However, Wi-Fi and the rollout of Wi-Fi across practices in Ayrshire and Arran had been delayed, and part of that was due to workforce, so we knew there wasn't going to be a quick fix to get that in. And also, I think as you all know as well, the footfall tended to change across all practices because of that. So we were encouraged by Health Protection Scotland to try and find other ways rather than face-to-face if possible, and things like prescriptions being collected and long-term condition reviews were postponed within the first wave. So what we actually found was happening was, even if we had got the Wi-Fi and the cardio devices could have been there, there were less opportunities to be able to use those for patients. But the common denominator across the system was that everybody was getting their prescriptions with long-term conditions from the local community pharmacy. So whether that was they were collecting it face-to-face or having somebody else go for it, or it was being delivered, it seemed to be that they were a link. So we had a chat to a very friendly pharmacy director who's got three sites across the valley that I work as a GP in as well, and suggested to him, rather than wait who knows how many months to be able to start off this pilot when the equipment was there and ready, would he have a think about if we could do some joined up working and think about how we could still do the screening within a smaller area rather than Ayrshire and Arran, we just focused on the Irvine Valley, and if he'd be able to help with us accessing those patients that were going in to collect their prescriptions. He's quite an innovative person himself, and he was really keen on the idea of trying something different and making the most of this kind of change within the pandemic. and agreed. So we trained up the staff. We took the cardio devices into there. We already had a secure email link from the pharmacy to the practice as well. And they were able to offer to screen patients for AF using the cardio device. And we set up a process in the background just for safety and quality checking so that we were able to, first of all, confirm what are these cardio devices doing? Can we trust them or not? What else can they detect or not detect as well? What are the patients and what are the staff going to feel about this process? And are they going to be able to maintain it? And then also, one thing that has been a barrier in the past is that feeling of there's already increasing workload in general practice. Will the double checking or will the outcome of finding this create more workload than is sustainable? And will it be able to become part of primary care practice, or does it need to be an enhanced service and get extra workforce behind it? So all of that happened over the space of 3 weeks in total. We managed to be able to get the service up and running and getting it well used, and it had had amazing results. So we found 4 cases of AF. One of those was a new diagnosis. 3 turned out to be patients who already had it, but obviously wanted to see if these things work. And the workload, although it was increased at our end, that we were having to do some bloods and do some ECGs and refer on patients, that the outcome of that was that work in balance was necessary, and there were unexpected benefits that we found in it too. There was tachycardia that was detected, I think, in about 7 or 8 of the patients, 11 in total, I'm just having a look there. And those tachycardias of the 11, we actually did have a closer look and think, why is that? And we managed to get most of them to settle with just a rest within the community pharmacy. And there was learning from that as well. So they were being able to help reassure these patients who it must have been a stress-induced thing that settled within a few minutes. And one of those patients who did have a tachycardia that didn't settle and came into the practice to have an ECG, went on to have further investigations and bloods done, and did have an underlying disorder that was quite serious and that had been managed to be treated early. So these things as well, it just makes you realize what the potential is for being able to do that. And the staff and the patients had no negatives to report, even the ones that were having to spend extra time doing the cardio and dispense the medicines. They said they were finding that they like to learn about using a new method, they like to learn more about the disease itself, and they like to be able to feel helpful and offer it to the patients. So I'm a great believer and supporter that this could be rolled out elsewhere.
Well, I mean, the reason I invited you on was, like, as discussed, was to sort of share some positivity and, you know, what can be done. And to be honest, you've delivered in the first 5 minutes, so I think we should just stop now. Maybe that was just brilliant. Really, I think that's a, you know, it's a, what would you call it? I'm a bit cynical about the word leadership, but there is leadership within that to go out and go and get it. And what I see there as well is a wee bit of, you know, clinical entrepreneurship as well. You know, you're understanding where your patients are, and that's, like, you know, as Matt will back up, that's, you know, the patients exist at community pharmacies across Scotland and the rest of the UK. So unbelievable. Before I sort of open it up, how did you measure it? Apart from obviously you've mentioned the people you found. Did you do any work in terms of sort of, you know, looking into the future in terms of cost savings and that kind of thing?
For cost savings, it's difficult because this is so preventative. You've really got to look at the consequences that are being avoided in it, which is more difficult to measure. The things that we found easiest to measure was the equivalent of the numbers needed to treat. So how many people are you going to have to screen before you find a case of AF? And although this was a small number of people, we did find that we needed to screen 72 people of all adults to be able to find a case. But then if you age adjust that to the over 65s, which is what has been recommended by the cross-party group on heart disease and stroke, then for over 65s, you only need to screen 27 to get that positive case. So, you know, you're not going to do this for nothing. There are patients out there with undiagnosed AF. And then we also looked at the data that was out there already and looked at the statistics. So there's approximately 50,000 people with undiagnosed AF in Scotland. So there's a potential for this screening program to catch pretty much all of those. And then we also looked at the cost effects of not being diagnosed with AF. So there's a high risk if you have undiagnosed AF that you go on to get stroke. And stroke disability and stroke care is one of the biggest costs within the NHS, and it takes up 5% of the budget. So cost-wise there, I'm sure there's somebody far more educated than I am to put all of that together. But from what I read about it, it says that there's a massive cost saving that's there for it. And also just that quality of life for the patients that do get detected and do manage to avoid having quite a significant disability.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. No, yeah, great insights. Yeah, I think avoiding AF strokes or AF related strokes is a noble endeavor. So however we progress that agenda is, money or not, seems like a good idea. Matt, how did that sound to you, and what experience have you had previously of these types of screening services? I suppose more from a deployment perspective in the network, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, first off, I mean, listening to Alexia and the sort of collaboration across primary care, between the GP practice there and community pharmacy, it's exactly what we want to see. It's exactly that type of recognition of each other's roles that we're looking to try and, I suppose, complement and roll out. Because I mean, we've got a number of challenges, in the NHS, whether it be the demographic challenge, the healthcare workforce, which is GP, pharmacy, we're not immune to that as we're hearing constantly. And then, you have got, and I hate the word that they use when they say burden of chronic disease, but there's, I know what they mean by it in terms of burden of cost and burden on the individual who's actually suffering from it, etc. So it's exactly that kind of primary disease prevention approach that I think can be good. There were some things that Alexia mentioned there that highlight the challenges in it. So if you go into a very generalized sense of saying, right, screening program open to all, then it probably opens you up to that kind of challenge of, is it cost effective? Is it is it right to just screen anybody that comes in? But if you pick the right cohorts for certain things, Alexia mentioned VEF, the over 65s, and of course in general, that maybe does happen as you go up that demographic spectrum. But for me, it's about making that case with the right types of cohorts so that you'll catch the vast bulk. And if we were developing services, then that's probably what you would have to do. We have developed some services in pharmacy already, obviously in community pharmacy, which obviously, if you want to say smoking cessation is a kind of screening thing, EHCs are different types of things, but definitely the accessibility of pharmacy, as you mentioned, Jonathan, the populations that are there, does offer that opportunity. We've said before, in terms of health inequalities, a lot of pharmacies in a lot of deprived areas as well. So probably catching these patients that maybe are reluctant to access health services, maybe in general terms in other ways, and you can maybe get that health education in. And Alexia's pointed out, the referral routes that she's probably developing through that, hopefully should absolutely be embedded through that service. And the more services that can be done through, I suppose, pharmacy playing its part in terms of that primary disease prevention, early identification route, then that's only going to improve those pathways and hopefully get the right people seen at the right time. But it is a balance. I think that general approach has been criticised in some quarters, and the evidence and some papers will say that's not the way to go for screening services. I think what Alexia did hint at as well is obviously patient acceptance seems very high for doing this type of thing in pharmacy, which is great. And most of the papers that I see, that does seem to be the case, that patients accept their pharmacist and their team. And you mentioned the team there as well, Alexia, actually developing themselves but actually doing it well and delivering that service. So well done, Alexa. Well done. I will speak to that director, and I will get the feedback from them as well. Take all that evidence, but that's a great example of how it can work.
It is. Yeah, can't say that enough, really. Very interesting. And Lindsay, your experience, we were talking beforehand, you've got experience, sounds lovely, back in Australia when you were over there. And your interest really in all of this is, I mean, I suppose the conversation has gone towards AF. That's the way it was sort of built. So, the big idea is to find the folk with AF to prevent AF related strokes. But do you have an opinion on the screening in the community, and also probably speaking more to your expertise or experience rather, do you have an opinion around the anticoagulation, perhaps of people that have been sort of already diagnosed with AF, because these people do exist in Scotland. There are you know, a lot of people who have known atrial fibrillation who are not anticoagulated. So could you speak to that a wee bit? Have you got any sort of thoughts or opinions around all of that?
Yes, I suppose just I would agree, just to go back to kind of Alexia and Matt in the discussion about community pharmacies' place in this. And I find it really, really important that we include kind of all sectors of care across all of the interfaces and try and work so much more integrated together to provide those better kind of seamless, we always talk about this seamless healthcare and a better transition across the interface. And I just think the more work that we can potentially do together as community pharmacy, general practice pharmacy, general practice clinicians, GPs, nursing, and secondary care services, and recognise each other's roles within as well, I think it's fantastic, because it doesn't, if we just take this service as an example, I'm sure that Alexia would probably say that this hasn't just benefited the cohort of patients that were tested from this one device. I would think probably the relationships between the community pharmacies and the GPs that were involved in this have probably been improved as well, to understand the different roles within the team and other, like, probably you're probably already thinking, what else could we do together and how else could we work together for potentially different disease states. So that in itself, I think, is fantastic, and it's great to hear that it's been done, and keen for it to keep getting done. From the anticoagulation side of it, and it was interesting talking just about that cost, the overall kind of cost benefit. One thing that's quite easy in Australia, because of the way that the health service works out there, it's quite easy to, if you intervene with a patient, you can say it cost the service $850 for the patients to see me today, and I've just saved a $90,000 procedure for revascularization, and I've just saved. So you don't even have to go into like the long-term savings of cost. You can actually pick out, because every single iota of treatment within the Australian healthcare system has a value to it. So just the dispensing procedure, seeing the pharmacist, seeing the consultant, seeing the nurse, and then having each of the procedures, it's all just really easy to find what the exact cost of that procedure is. So instantly I can say, oh, I found an AF case, I'm anticoagulating them, I could have prevented a stroke, so I've prevented $90,000 of revascularization, and then don't even need to tell you about the rest of the long-term, you know, benefits of what I've done. So that's quite interesting in itself, coming back, having been in NHS, going out to Australia in the slightly kind of different system, to come back here to evidence those savings is a bit more complex, and it's really the health economists you rely on to do, you know, the vast bulk of that side of it. But just from the patient care side, if in my career I can prevent one person having a really debilitating stroke, that in itself is an achievement, a massive achievement. And I think we would all agree with that. If we can benefit one person's life outcomes, that's huge. But the same with anticoagulation. So what we showed in one of the research topics we looked at in Australia was actually an English trainee pharmacist that came out to Australia to do her final fourth year dissertation. And we looked at patients' anticoagulation knowledge and the difference between the anticoagulation knowledge of warfarin and the anticoagulation knowledge in DOAX, and substantial difference statistically. Important difference was shown that the knowledge of warfarin was exponentially greater than the knowledge of the patients on DOAX. And we obviously didn't take that research any further as to why, but you can draw a number of conclusions. But my kind of gut feeling is every patient kind of knew what warfarin was because their brother, sister, auntie, uncle, somebody at the bowls club was on it, and it was rat poison, and that was how it had first been invented. And, you know, they kind of gave you all this history behind warfarin. And then they knew that they couldn't take aspirin with it, and they couldn't buy things over the counter with it. And if they had a bleed, they had to do this and they had to do that. And you asked the patients about that were on the DOACs, all of a similar age, they were all on it for AF. And they just said, oh, it's just a tablet. It's just like any other tablet. I take a statin, I take this, I take that, and I just take them all. And interesting how few knew the real depth of why they were taking it, the kind of benefits to taking it, the dangers to taking it, the importance of what they had to do. And I think not only do all of us as healthcare professionals play a really important part in that, I think community pharmacy plays a massive part on that and has a massive place to play. We've done, when I used to work down in Glasgow, we did a kind of community pharmacy local enhanced service. And Matt, you can probably correct me if there's still some of these going on across the country, but about counselling patients really heavily on their warfarin when they get warfarin out. I don't believe that's ever been done for DOACs anywhere, but actually it's a huge area that just because the tablet that doesn't need as close monitoring doesn't mean that it doesn't come with the same risks and you don't have to understand it just as much. So I've got huge passion to make sure that like community pharmacy at that easily accessible, constantly seeing the patient every 2 months when they go to collect their prescription, constantly having that ability to speak to the patient when they're collecting their prescription and reminding them of the importance of carrying their alert cards and letting dentists know and letting other healthcare professionals know. So I think not only in the screening but also in the counselling, community pharmacy just have got so much they can give to just ensure patient safety around this and the compliance as well, not just all the safety risks, the actual importance of taking this every day and not forgetting, and you know, that side of it.
And of course, what that's really interesting, Lindsay, brilliant. I mean, what correct me if I'm wrong, learned friends, one of the consequences of COVID and the pandemic and the, you know, the shutting down of face-to-face, of course, was there was, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a move to push people onto DOACs, appropriately, of course, to prevent that face-to-face contact. Do you think, and Lindsay, just to take that on a wee bit, do you think, I mean, N equals one, but you've done a lot of research, you've done research in this area, so it's interesting. Do you think there's a problem then with adherence, particularly with DOACs? Maybe, you know, I'm thinking after, I don't know, 6 to 8 months of being on a DOAC, you know, are you sitting on the couch thinking, oh, I don't feel any better. Nothing's happened. So I'll just not take it. Do you think that's an issue?
I think it probably could be an issue. And I'm sure there's been other research done in this. But I think that constantly seeing your nurse or the INR clinic healthcare professional that's doing your INR check, constantly reminding you that you're on a really important drug, that if you don't take it, your INR goes off. And if you take too much of it or it goes off, and there's dangers around all of that. But the DOAC is just the take it every day. But I've drawn, I can't even count how many times on a piece of paper drawn the graph for the patient about you take your warfarin and you get up to there and it goes like that and you forget it and it goes down a wee bit and it blips and it comes back up. You take your DOAC, you don't take your DOAC. You take your DOAC, you don't take your DOAC. And reminding them that actually you don't take it for a day, you're just as much risk of having a stroke as you were before I started this medication for you. And kind of reminding them about the importance of that adherence and when to take it and everything. So I suppose even though they're not going to see their nurse or their, you know, whoever's doing their INR, they are hopefully still having some form of interaction with their community pharmacy. And I think that's maybe where community pharmacy can additionally come in.
Perfect. Matt, we're using GoTo to do this, and none of us know how to use the raise hand function. So Matt's raised his actual hand. Matt.
Yeah, I think that's actually really interesting what Lindsay said, you know, about the you know, warfarin and her experience of you know, patient. And I think that probably is true, to be honest. And I suppose that's reflected in a bit. We've done our own, I suppose, focused medicine screening through the the contractual framework and, you know, the pharmacy care record, where we focused on, you know, methotrexate, warfarin, you know, being the first two high risk medicines. So we, you know, a number of years ago now, obviously went that, but we've never taken that on, you know, and probably went with a pattern of prescribing to hopefully, you know, there's the new medicines tool, etc. as well. So hopefully there are pharmacists, and I'm sure there are, that, you know, if I see a first presentation with a prescription for a DOAC, that I absolutely would pick that up with a patient. And I'm sure that does happen. But I think even in our own practice and the way we've set up the systems, we've probably just missed a trick there to say, you know, it's you know, anticoagulation in general as an overarching subject that we should be, you know, picking up on and developing. So, you know, and there's probably something in, you know, the Medicines Care and Review Service for that to develop at some point in the future, you know, as an overarching heading. And so, yeah, it's just interesting that Lindsay's made me reflect on that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Alexia?
The same, Matt. Like, I thought it was really, really interesting listening to what Lindsay said, and there's truth in all of that, and that understanding probably isn't as good there with the DOAC, just anecdotally from patients that I see. And I was going to ask Matt. So, Matt, when I'm listening to Lindsay and all of this and thinking, yeah, there's a need there, and counselling patients does take time, and sometimes just a one-off conversation isn't as good as some repeated information. And there's this push at the moment as well towards the supported self-management and the use of tech, and thinking with my tech hat on too, are there any tech pathways or support services that can be offered alongside the community pharmacy to be able to give that information over in a more repetitive way? I'm just thinking, we've got a COPD, newly diagnosed COPD service, which for 2 weeks just one way texts patients some information, and it's gone down really well, and there's positive feedback from it. Is there anything happening there in the pharmacy world?
I'll be honest, Alexia, and say I'm not sure if there's anything at scale that's happening to that effect. In fact, I'm quite sure that there's not, but I mean, I completely agree with you. I think there is a way, you know. I suppose it's, for me as a pharmacist and a community pharmacist, it's about certainly with that initial presentation and maybe the second and third presentations, just checking in with patients and seeing how they're getting on with it. To Lindsay's point around, you know, concordance with medication, you know, and you would see this at the GP practice, how often are they ordering it? You know, is it, you know, I know there is the data that you can get through, you know, prescribing systems to show, you know, just basic things like that. But I think what you're saying and the use of tech is probably quite an interesting one for me, this kind of personalised, person-centred care around that. There's bound to be systems that we can use to, you know, we use text message reminder systems to tell people that their medicines are ready, for example. So, you know, we should be able to develop those in a clinical sense to actually support patients take their medicines. It can't be beyond the wit of people to actually do that. I'll talk a wee bit about more of the digital stuff maybe in a few minutes.
I was just going to say that's a really interesting point as well, to keep going on it. So just we used to do for our really complex patients that we discharged, that were discharged on the DOAC because the ADF post MI, so we also then would discharge them on aspirin and clopidogrel, and we would actually do a phone call follow-up. So we would do their point of discharge with a medicines information sheet. We would then do a phone call follow-up 1 to 2 weeks after discharge, and a phone call follow-up 3 months after discharge. And then we would also see them 6 months after discharge. And this was all in the hospital outpatient setting, and 12 months after discharge. But that's really person-centered, heavy, requiring, and there's got to be things like completely, I just can't think of any at the moment, but like Repatha for evolocumab for cholesterol, is there's a really simple patient video that's two minutes, and I get all the patients to watch it. There's not many, to be fair, that I start here, but I used to get loads started in secondary care from the lipid clinic. But I wonder even if there's things like that we could utilise, just really short, snappy, you know, that we're sending them a text message with a link to watch a short patient video to really engage them and reminding them, this is why you're taking your medicines, this is what your medicines are for. Because because often we all know they don't pick it up at point of diagnosis because there's so much else going on as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there's a lot of good stuff in the third sector as well. You know, having done a wee bit of work in the past with the Stroke Association, you know, Diabetes UK, there's a lot of good stuff for patients in various areas. And actually, I think I can hear some people say, oh, but you're doing us out of a job. We're pharmacists. We should be we're meant to be teaching them about medicines, you know, GPs, you know, we can teach them. Actually, I think, you know, for the sustainability of healthcare and for all our sanity, you know, we need a bit of support here. And I think there is stuff, if you just look a bit further afield, you know, that can be tapped into without actually really costing anything else other than just signposting to it.
So I think it's a really fascinating conversation, and we're motoring through the time already. As I was listening to everyone there, I was thinking back to like where, you know, like modern pharmacy practice came from. So it's this concept of pharmaceutical care, isn't it? You know, all our you know, policy documents from Bill Scott to Rosemary Parr, and I'm sure Alison Strath will have her own take on it. You know, those are all built on that Hepler and Strand, you know, pharmaceutical care thing. I just wonder, I mean, it's not a plug, but it has come up in conversation, so I will mention it. But so is there a new specialty? I mean, I would argue there is. I think there's a new, and I was hoping we would get to somewhere near this point in the conversation. Is there a new version of pharmaceutical care emerging? Is it, or is there a new branch of it emerging? And you might refer to that as technoceutical care, you know, technology-enabled pharmaceutical care. I absolutely think there is. Now, one question, maybe to sort of draw it to a bit of a close, but we can keep going for a while, is with all these things, like, I suppose pharmacy and practice is a business, right? Matt represents, so Matt's is a, you know, Community Pharmacy Scotland is a, what would you say, a trade organisation, sort of member organisation for, and yep. they represent businesses, right? Yep. So Lindsay works for the NHS, Alexia works for the NHS. So it's an interesting dynamic on this call. So there's private and public sector. I used to work in the NHS, of course. So I've seen both sides. And it's fascinating because all these conversations about screening, about, you know, the use of the Cardia, it's certainly not to criticise you, Alexia, at all. It's not my intention. But one of my worries about an excellent, bit of innovation like what you have done is it sustainable, and you know, who's going to take it forward, and my opinion, I mean, it's just my opinion, let's have a Barney about it, but my opinion is there needs to be money, and it's a really interesting conversation about where that money comes from, actually. There are some in the market that would say NHS is a core service and are some of these things more advanced. You know, if we know as pharmacists that there's a pressing need to sort of address an adherence problem in the DOAC space, should we be getting on and doing that? I don't know. I'm just starting the chat about it. You know, I honestly don't know. There's an awful lot of cynicism about the private sector too. Business in the right hands does great things. We need to look after the NHS. Hopefully I've covered all bases. I'll throw that open to the floor. How do we make sure that amazing thing, you know, case studies like what Alexia has achieved in her locality are not just, they're not even, I was saying this before the call, like they're not even, there's not even a fuss about them, just nothing happens, you know, and there's no money follows the innovation. And so help me out, how do we sort of take these things forward? Who wants to go first? Matt.
Yeah, I'll go then, Jonathan. And I'll say, you know, all independent contractors are businesses. Just say that. But anyway, yes. I think it's a good question. I think it's, you know, I think the former Cabinet Secretary for Health, I was at a meeting with her once where she was just so exasperated with the amount of pilotitis and the amount of stuff that's going on. Why can we not just do it? And I think, you know, whether we like it or not, the NHS is a complex system to navigate, and that that shouldn't be a barrier to actually doing the right thing. And I think that's absolutely it. And it's about making that business case. I mean, I did say I could come back to the digital space that CPS has kind of been dabbling in recently with some members. Is it related to AF? It's hypertension, and it's about taking digitally transforming, hypertension management and kind of doing things with patients there. Now we've just been doing it with some pharmacies and their teams. So we've just been, proof of concept stuff around them getting monitors, etc., and feeding it back into a platform, etc. So it's very, very early, and but I think the digital space is absolutely somewhere that we need to go, Jonathan, and answer to your question about the kind of farm tech. I think it's complementing practice, and it's how you get that appropriately integrated. And I think we absolutely need to go that way. The single patient record, the whole, that platform is being developed, and that's something that I think my limited knowledge of IT, you should be able to plug in, across the Lindsay's point earlier, across secondary, primary care, across the interface, you should be able to plug into that. I think that will make things easier. But I think it can't, one criticism of the NHS as an entity is that innovation can be quite difficult and can take a long time to happen, innit? And you really need to keep plugging away to make that change happen. So things like Alexia obviously has went to a very localised level to do that. She's identified relationships locally to do that. And hopefully there's evidence that comes out of that allows that to be scaled to some degree. But some of the stuff has made its way up the way, for pharmacy. So, the smoking cessation EHC, but they were quite easy. They were quite easy to do. Not a lot of technology involved in those early stages for us. Disease screening prevention is probably because of the evidence base behind it. It's not quite as strong, it needs to be quite focused. There needs to be that evidence created to do it. And it is about that cost effectiveness, and it's effectiveness versus cost effectiveness, isn't it, that needs to be done. But Lindsay's illustrated, in Australia, when you've got that interesting mix of, I'm not suggesting this at all, private versus, publicly funded healthcare, they actually put a value in things quite, because they're used to that in these systems. They do the same in America, and stuff like that as well. I don't know if we need to get that kind of mindset in the NHS. I'm not suggesting we move to that type of integrate, mixed model, but that mindset might help us.
Yeah, I don't know the answer, Matt, but I take all your points. But I suppose as someone who's started PIP, I mean, PIP's just a little business, it's a consultancy basically. But there's total jeopardy all of the time, that's my life, and that I love it, but it wouldn't be for anybody. But it really, I'll tell you something, it really clarifies where you put your energy. Because if I make a mistake, I feel, I have many, many good ideas that I've had, just that there's just no money in it. So I think I was, as you were speaking, one thing came to mind through the pandemic was NHS near me. So that was a big sort of event that happened, i.e. the pandemic, and there was a massive pivot, but it was an enforced pivot. And it was really interesting because it wasn't money driven with the NHS, but it did happen. I thought that was a really interesting case study. Is it the case that strategically placed bollards could make the NHS do something different? I don't know. Alexia?
Yeah, just thinking as you were both chatting, and I never really touched, when I was giving an overview of this project, I didn't really touch on those that weren't 100% behind this happening either, which is probably now a good time to discuss it, because it is more about that workload capacity, financial capacity, having work to do, and this being seen as an extra. So the conversations that I did have are quite similar to what you're saying, actually. So within the practice itself, when I was saying, look, this is something that I really want to do, and this is how I think we can go about it, some of the hesitancy from staff was about, will I have to do this? When will I have time to do this? I haven't got time to do this, which is completely reasonable. Do you know, it's something extra that isn't part of the GMS contract. It's not part of something that they're normally doing, and everyone's busy day to day as it is. So I did reassure them, and I said, this is something that I will be overseeing, and I'm going to be doing this in my own time. Don't worry, but you need to be aware so that if these do appear, you know what's going on. So there was that there already. You know, they were worried about that. And what we captured over the 3 weeks was that in those 3 weeks, there were 15 15 cardiac outputs that needed a GP to look at. So I'd looked at them all, but it was the 15 that would, you know, when we worked forward then to be able to do it. So, I mean, that I can do in a couple of minutes for each one, you know, or a minute really. So that's about 15 minutes in 3 weeks. And then there were three patients who needed a face-to-face appointment for a 12-lead ECG or for bloods. So that is talking, and a 12-lead ECG is normally about 20 minutes and a blood test 10 minutes. So you're talking a maximum of an hour of time there in appointment basis. That's over 3 weeks. So that's 20 minutes a week. So sort of 15 minutes of clinician time, 20 minutes of practice nurse time. And then there was one referral that needed to be done from the background of that. So that was two patient appointments to precede them to that. So another 20 minutes of GP appointment time in those 3 weeks. So it isn't huge. So I could only say that to them afterwards. And then there was much more relief, really, from the practice that they could quantify, what is this going to mean week by week? Am I really going to get these landing in my inbox and not be able to deal with them? Is everybody going to go and get it done on the same day? And that on-call GP can't kind of look at everything and the safety isn't there. So we've kind of got those numbers to work through those things. So that helped the GP side of the fence for, well, what does this mean and what does that do? And the other thing that I said to people that I work with is, we are going to be getting these from smartwatches or from Apple devices or from something else anyway. This is something that people are doing and they'll bring it to us. So why should we wait for them to do it and work it out? Why not just offer it anyway? Because it's happening and we're going to be ahead of the wave to be able to do it. And so then that reason, though, as well, I see some nodding heads, is why, Jonathan, I also am like, well, maybe in fact, if they're going to be doing this anyway, is this not something that could be a quality about a community pharmacy that makes people want to use them, and that could be something that would encourage patients through the door?
I'm itching to come in because what you've said just resonates with me, and like not the businessy bit, but what you describe there is like the startup cycle. I've done that many, many times. It's just, you know, you think of something, you think of an idea, you execute it for no money, and then but the step beyond what you've done is you've come up with a good idea with a solid evidence base, as Lindsay has clarified, with, you know, so clearly stating that the return on clinical investment and financial investment in Australia. So is it okay to take that leap and sell it? I'm not sure. And by selling it, I mean actually allowing third party companies in. It doesn't always mean you as a GP selling it. It means, you know, giving away data or giving away some of that, you know, that whole thing that you've invented, the IP around that, the intellectual property. So I just found it fascinating what you're saying. We are going to have to draw it to a close. I'm gutted because I think we're just getting going. Lindsay wants to come in though.
I just want to say one thing. So I think the majority of us that went to university to do pharmacy went to do pharmacy to become clinicians. Yes, some of us want to be business managers and make our millions within business, but I think the majority, there is definitely an absolute part there that we want to be clinicians. And I think services like this allow us to continue within the marketplace, because I think, like, whilst I don't particularly want pharmacy to go down the online pharmacy route, as a personal opinion, because I think that actually that face-to-face is really heavily important, that patients see their pharmacist in a pharmacy, because we have proven time and time again how much we can do in a face-to-face. We would use technology to complement, not replace us. But I think the more services that we can deliver in community pharmacy, and Matt will know this, coming away from the model of just constant, it's the dispensing, dispensing, dispensing that gets all your income. Actually, let's be pharmacists, be clinicians, be patient facing, and do whatever we can to improve and enhance the patient journey. And that's my core value is, as a pharmacist, always there to do. And I think a lot of us, that is what we want to do. We want to do whatever we possibly can do to enhance patient outcomes.
Exactly. We will finish it now. But Alexia, going back to, very interesting, Lindsay, but just to finish what you said, Alexia, I think the point that you make there is very well made, because the demand in the system is the demand. And delivering that, you know, servicing that demand is becoming cheaper and cheaper and cheaper with technology. Now, I worry that not just the NHS, but professions as well are being left behind potentially. And the patient is just going straight to the private company to get the service that they desire. Now, all sorts of good sides and downsides. You know, are those companies picking off the easy stuff? Maybe not. Maybe they're finding AF as the watches do, but maybe that's a whole other conversation we need to have. But I'm gonna finish it there and just say thank you so much to everyone. Fascinating chat. Like, I hope the powers that be have been watching. Very constructive, very convivial, and just the way I like it. And lovely to see everyone. And yeah, can we do it face to face next time? I think that would be better.
Absolutely, Jonathan.
Thank you all for coming, and we'll just finish it there. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks, Jonathan.